All right, remember, the machine knows if you're lying. First statement, Carvana will give you a real offer on your car all online.
False.
True, actually. You can sell your car in minutes.
False? That's gotta be...
True again. Carvana will pick up your car from your door, or you can drop it off at one of their car vending machines.
Sounds too good to be true, so true.
Finally caught on. Nice job. Honesty isn't just their policy, it's their entire model. Sell your car today, too.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
Okay, let's unpack this. When you think of Sarah Silverman, what immediately springs to mind? Is it the fearless comedian pushing boundaries, maybe with that smile?
Yeah, or maybe the voice of Vanellope.
Right. The sweet voice of a beloved Disney character.
Yeah.
Or maybe the activist stirring national conversation.
It's got to be all of it, really.
For us, it's that entire dazzling, sometimes, well, confounding constellation of roles and personalities.
Right.
She's a performer who consistently defies easy categorization.
Absolutely. Known for her signature blend of edgy humor, sharp wit,
and a surprisingly profound vulnerability.
Yeah.
It often catches you off guard, doesn't it?
It really does. She sparks conversation, challenges norms, and, well, she's never, ever boring.
Definitely not. Today, we're taking a deep dive into the extraordinary career and complex persona of Sarah Kate Silverman, a comedian, actress, writer, and activist.
Her influence stretches across stand-up, television, film, digital media, pretty much everywhere.
It's been a truly fascinating journey.
Yeah.
You know, marked by both groundbreaking success and, yeah, significant controversy.
All underpinned by that fierce individual voice.
And this deep dive isn't just a surface-level scan. We've pulled together a rich stack of sources.
Yeah. Detailed biographical accounts tracing her roots, comprehensive career milestones charting her ascent,
and candid insights into her personal life, her political engagements, too.
Our mission, really, is to provide you, our listener, with a truly comprehensive, nuanced understanding of Sarah Silverman.
Exactly. From her bold comedic genius to her, well, deeply personal revelations and her ever-evolving political voice.
We want you to walk away feeling well-informed, maybe a little more enlightened, about one of comedy's most singular and, frankly, enduring figures.
What's truly fascinating here is how her career isn't just a straight line, is it?
Not at all. It's a dynamic, constantly evolving narrative. It's not simply about the jokes she tells or the character she embodies.
Right.
It's about the life she's lived, every triumph, every setback, every deeply personal revelation that informs and enriches every facet of her public persona.
So we'll be connecting the dots.
We'll be connecting the dots between these diverse aspects to paint a much bigger picture of who she is as an artist and a public figure.
Okay.
We'll start by exploring her early life, that unique environment that shaped her perspective. Then we'll trace her audacious comedic beginnings.
Including that challenging stint on Saturday Night Live.
Oh, yeah, the infamous SNL experience. From there, we'll move into her groundbreaking shows, her significant career expansions into film, beloved voice acting.
And then?
Then we'll dive deep into the often controversial yet deeply personal approach she takes to humor and life.
And finally?
Finally, we'll peel back another layer, looking at the woman beyond the jokes, her health, her relationships, and the powerful, sometimes painful role her personal experiences play in her public and artistic life.
That's a crucial point, and it leads us directly to her beginning, doesn't it?
Absolutely. To truly understand the Sarah Silverman we know today, we have to go back to those formative years.
Right. Sarah Kate Silverman, born December 1st, 1970, Concord, New Hampshire.
And raised mostly in Manchester and Bedford, New Hampshire.
And it certainly wasn't a quiet, conventional upbringing. Her family life undeniably laid the foundation for her unique worldview.
Definitely. Her mother, Beth Ann Halpin, she passed away in 2015. She was far from a typical homemaker.
Right. She was George McGovern's personal campaign photographer.
Yeah. Which immediately tells you something significant, doesn't it? About the political engagement, the progressive leanings that likely, you know, permeated their household.
And beyond politics, her mother also founded the new Thilliam Players Theater Company.
So you've got this strong, creative, theatrical, performative influence right from Sarah's earliest years.
Exactly. That combination, political passion, artistic expression, seems almost tailor-made to foster the kind of boundary-pushing artist Silverman would become.
And her father, Donald Silverman, who recently passed away in 2023, he contributed to this rich and, well, somewhat unconventional environment, too.
How so?
Well, he trained as a social worker, which hints at maybe a foundational thread of empathy, a desire to understand people, perhaps an awareness of societal issues. But he also ran a clothing store called Crazy Sophie's Outlet.
Crazy Sophie's Outlet, okay.
Imagine that blend. A social worker running an offbeat clothing store. It's quite a mix.
Yeah, that dynamic mix of social consciousness, artistic freedom, and a touch of the unconventional. It paints a vivid picture of a home where diverse ideas and experiences were not only present, but actively encouraged.
It's absolutely crucial to see how these parental influences, both politically engaged and creatively driven, clearly laid the groundwork.
For the type of performer, satirist, and activist she'd become.
Exactly. Always willing to look at the world from a slightly skewed, deeply insightful angle.
She was also the youngest of five children.
Right, which, as anyone who's the youngest knows, comes with its own unique dynamic.
You're often the family rebel, the observer.
Or the one trying to get attention, yeah. Mm-hmm. Her older sisters include Susan Silverman, who is a reform rabbi.
Okay, interesting.
Writer Jodine Spire and actress Laura Silverman, who many will recognize from Sarah's own show.
Right. They played sisters on the show, too.
They did. There was also the tragic loss of her infant brother, Jeffrey Michael, who passed away at just 3 months old.
That's incredibly sad. While not something she often speaks about publicly in detail, such an event undoubtedly leaves an indelible, quiet mark on a family.
Shaping perspectives on life, loss, and maybe even the fragility that often underpins her most poignant humor.
Her heritage is another significant, often explored part of her identity and, you know, her work.
Absolutely. Silverman is of Ashkenazi Jewish descent, ancestors from Poland and Russia.
And she's spoken about her maternal grandmother escaping the Holocaust.
Yes, a powerful, sobering link to a history of persecution and resilience that clearly informs her worldview and her often fearless approach to tackling difficult subjects.
And while she deeply identifies herself as culturally Jewish, a theme she frequently explores, often satirizes in her work.
She also states she is non-religious or agnostic.
Which gives her a unique vantage point, doesn't it?
Totally. She can comment on Jewish culture from an insider's perspective, appreciating its richness, while maintaining a critical distance from religious dogma.
Which allows her to probe its complexities with, well, irreverence.
Exactly. And a particularly poignant moment reflecting this connection was her attendance at the first Western Wall menorah lighting by women in 2014.
Showing her engagement with her heritage.
Yeah, not through strict religious observance necessarily, but through a commitment to cultural identity and evolving traditions.
Okay, now let's talk about the genesis of a comedian. From that vibrant, politically charged environment, you might expect a clear path to stardom.
But Sarah Silverman's journey into comedy began not with a bang, but by her own admission, with a whimper.
Right. Picture this. 17-year-old Sarah stepping onto a Boston stage for her very first stand-up performance.
Only for it to be, in her own words, awful, a complete flop.
Yet this wasn't the end, but rather the defiant beginning.
Yeah.
What do you think enabled that 17-year-old to push past such a devastating first attempt? So many would just give up.
It's a fantastic question, and it speaks volumes about her inherent resilience, her self-belief, I think.
Right.
That kind of early failure can either crush you or forge you. And in her case, it clearly hardened her resolve.
So instead of retreating...
She chose to graduate from the Derryfield School in 1989, attend New York University for just a year.
Only a year.
Just a year. Then made the incredibly bold, almost defiant decision to leave to pursue stand-up full-time in the fiercely competitive Greenwich Village scene.
Wow. That takes an extraordinary kind of conviction, doesn't it?
It really does. It suggests an unwavering belief in her comedic voice, even after that initial stumble.
And maybe it taught her something.
Perhaps, crucially, it taught her to embrace the discomfort, to push past the fear of not being liked, a trait that would become a hallmark of her unapologetic style.
That immediate, unvarnished feedback of live comedy, a baptism by fire.
Undeniably, it shaped her willingness to tackle difficult, often uncomfortable subjects right from the very beginning.
So, from the crucible of Greenwich Village, she launched into her professional stand-up career in 1992.
Pretty quickly, yeah. And within a year, found herself on one of comedy's biggest stages, Saturday Night Live.
She joined the cast in 1993, 19th season, as both a writer and a featured player for 18 weeks. For many, that's the pinnacle, the dream job.
It is. But her time on SNL is a really insightful, if brief, chapter in her career.
Which is right.
Despite being brought on as a writer, only one of her sketches ever made it to dress rehearsal, and none actually aired.
None at all. Wow.
Though she did appear in smaller acting roles, This challenging experience, lasting just one season, ended with her being fired.
A common narrative for many talented comedians at SNL, unfortunately.
True, but her reflections on it are particularly telling. Former SNL writer Bob Odenkirk, who clearly recognized her unique talent, observed something interesting.
What was that?
He said, she's got her own voice. She's very much Sarah Silverman all the time. She can play a character, but she doesn't disappear into the character.
So her distinctiveness, which became her strength later,
might have actually been a poor fit for SNL's ensemble-driven format, which often demands a certain malleability.
Yeah, the show requires players to inhabit all sorts of characters. Her inability or unwillingness to fully shed her own identity likely contributed to the disconnect.
Seems plausible.
So what does this all mean for her trajectory? Being fired from SNL is often seen as a failure, a setback.
For many, yes. But for Silverman, it became a defining moment that actually strengthened her resolve.
And maybe prevented her from being pigeonholed.
Perhaps serendipitously, yes. Silverman herself has reflected that she wasn't ready for SNL at that point.
She admitted it hurt her confidence.
For about a year, she said. But she also credits that experience with making her so tough, asserting that after SNL, nothing could really hurt her in the same way.
That's an extraordinary way to frame a setback.
Isn't it? She's even expressed gratitude that her time there was short, precisely because it didn't define her.
Which allowed her the freedom to forge her own path.
Exactly. Rather than being eternally linked to the show's style, it's a testament to her self-awareness, really, that she could recognize the value of not fitting in.
And she even parodied the experience.
She did, on The Larry Sanders Show in 1996, playing a new staff writer whose jokes are consistently ignored, subtly hinting at the chauvinism she might have perceived in that male-dominated writer's room.
Clever. Very clever, biting commentary delivered with her signature deadpan.
It's a fantastic example of how perceived setbacks can be alchemized into strength, especially for an artist developing such a distinct voice.
It pushed her to cultivate an even more singular style.
Right. And this period also saw her expanding her reach beyond just stand-up. She starred in HBO's sketch comedy series, Mr. Show, with Bob and David.
Mr. Show. Classic. 1995 to 1997.
Working alongside other innovative comedians like Bob Odenkirk and David Cross, Mr. Show was known for its surreal, non-sequitur sketches, often with an anti-establishment sensibility.
Which sounds like fertile ground for Silverman.
Definitely. To further hone her sketch chops and embrace absurdity, a quality central to her later work.
She also landed her first leading film role around then.
Yes, in the 1997 indie film Who's the Caboose?
Yeah.
About comedians trying to make it in L.A.
Did it get a wide release?
No, it never received widespread theatrical release. But the experience was clearly significant because she later revisited that character in a 6-episode TV sequel called Pilot Season.
Interesting. Shows that thread of meta-humor, exploring the realities of show business.
Turning her own journey into fodder for her art, yeah. And her network stand-up debut happened around this time, too.
On Letterman.
The Late Show with David Letterman, July 3, 1997, a big step onto a mainstream platform.
Showing her unique voice to a national audience.
And her presence really started to expand across television with diverse guest roles, letting her experiment.
Like Star Trek, Voyager, I remember that.
Yeah, 1996, a two-parter where she played a temporal agent, showed an early ability for more dramatic sci-fi roles.
Then Seinfeld in 97.
Right. Kramer's unconventional girlfriend, Emily, very memorable.
And VIP, Greg the Bunny.
She was a series regular on Greg the Bunny in 2002, that surreal puppet sitcom, perfectly suited to her.
And her voice work.
Crucially, she began her long-running voice work as Hadassah Guberman on Crank Yankers in 2002.
Hadassah.
Oh my gosh.
A brash, often outrageous Jewish woman, a role that truly showcased her ability to create memorable, offensive, yet hilarious characters with just her voice. Leaning into caricature expertly.
And smaller film parts started adding up.
Yeah, scene-stealing parts in a mix of comic and serious roles. There's something about Mary, School of Rock, Heartbreakers, Funny People.
Showing versatility, quietly building that acting resume.
Definitely.
But it was her 2005 concert film, Sarah Silverman, Jesus is Magic, that really cemented her as a force, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Based on her one-woman show, directed by Liam Lynch.
A decent reviews, made some money.
64% on Rotten Tomatoes, about $1.3 million at the box office, signaled a growing public appetite for her unique brand of fearless comedy.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, Jesus, his magic wasn't just a stand-up special, was it?
Not at all. It was a carefully crafted comedic manifesto. It showcased her willingness to tackle social taboos, controversial topics.
Racism, sexism, homophobia, politics, religion.
All of it, often through a satirical or deadpan endorsement that made audiences both laugh and squirm, sometimes simultaneously.
She wasn't just telling jokes, she was pushing boundaries, making people uncomfortable.
Forcing them to confront their own biases, yeah. Even if the method itself was sometimes jarring or shocking.
Her material often delved into blue comedy, right? Explicit, raw stuff.
Yeah, blue comedy, black comedy, finding humor in morbid or dark subjects. She'd use these styles to endorse controversial statements satirically.
With that seemingly innocent delivery that made the punchline hit harder.
Exactly. The widespread publicity around the film cover features in Slate, Hebe magazine, appearances on Comedy Central roasts, further solidified her profile.
As an unmissable, often polarizing, undeniably original voice.
It announced, unequivocally, Sarah Silverman is here, and she's not pulling any punches.
Which brings us to a pivotal era, 2007 to 2010. Sitcom stardom, viral moments, more controversy.
The Sarah Silverman Program debuted on Comedy Central February 2007. Big hit right away.
1.81 million viewers, substantial for cable comedy then.
The show is this semi-fictionalized, absurdist take on her day-to-day adventures. Her character, also Sarah Silverman, was a narcissist.
Who often got into hilariously misguided, socially inappropriate situations.
And it cleverly starred her real-life sister Laura as her on-screen sibling, blurring those lines between reality and fiction.
Plus, a cast of other great comedians, many from Mr. Show, created this wonderfully bizarre ensemble.
The program itself was a direct, amplified extension of her stand-up persona. It let her explore her comedic themes and characters in a more sustained narrative format.
It was critically acclaimed too, right?
Right.
Got an Emmy nomination.
Yeah, primetime Emmy nom for Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series. Significant because it acknowledged her unique ability to blend the absurd with often uncomfortable social commentary in a sitcom structure.
A typical episode might involve her character taking some utterly offensive stance.
And pursuing it with unwavering, blissful ignorance, highlighting the absurdities of prejudice or self-absorption through exaggerated satire.
And, of course, that memorable Emmy Awards appearance wearing a fake mustache.
Classic Silverman. Perfectly encapsulated her brand. Self-aware absurdity mixed with refreshing irreverence, challenging the event's formality with a wink.
The show ran for 3 seasons before Comedy Central canceled it.
But its impact on her visibility and comedic identity was undeniable.
She certainly didn't shy away from the spotlight during this time, and controversy often followed her.
Like a shadow, yeah. June 2007 hosted the MTV Movie Awards, made that widely reported controversial joke about Paris Hilton's upcoming jail sentence.
Hilton was in the audience, visibly uncomfortable, sparked immediate...
Then, just a few months later, September 2007, hosted the MTV Video Music Awards, mocked Britney Spears' comeback performance.
Criticized her clothes, called her sons adorable mistakes. That drew significant criticism, too. Many found it unnecessarily cruel.
While Silverman later expressed regret for both incidents in 2021, claiming she hadn't seen Spears' performance.
These moments really highlight the fine line she walked and sometimes tripped over between edgy satire and what many perceived as genuine, unkind offense.
They underscore the volatile nature of live comedy, especially delivered without full awareness of context or impact.
They certainly do. Shows, even for her, public perception shifts.
Yeah.
And the impact of a joke can be unforeseen, especially targeting real people live.
But perhaps one of the most culturally resonant moments of this period, certainly one of her most audacious and iconic,
was the legendary I'm fucking Matt Damon.
Oh, yeah. You see how she constantly pushes the envelope, even in her personal relationships?
That video wasn't just comedy. It was a cultural moment. Groundbreaking meta humor, proving the power of viral content before viral was even fully understood.
I remember exactly where I was when that dropped. The internet collectively gasped and then burst out laughing.
It was January 2008. Appeared on Jimmy Kimmel Live to show her then-boyfriend Jimmy Kimmel a special video.
And the video was this brilliantly produced musical duet with Matt Damon himself.
Singing with gleeful abandon about having an affair behind Kimmel's back.
It became an instant YouTube sensation, millions of views overnight, earned her a primetime Emmy for outstanding original music and lyrics.
And later a Creative Arts Emmy for writing the song. The audacity, using her real relationship, a massive star, a musical number. incredible public comedic theater.
Unprecedented, really. And Kimmel, of course, responded with his own star-studded viral video, I'm fucking Ben Affleck.
Featuring everyone. A brilliant, public, hilariously uncomfortable comedic exchange that captivated millions. Set a new bar for celebrity viral content.
Absolutely. And it wasn't just the audacity. It was a masterclass in using personal relationships and public platforms for comedic effect.
Blurring the lines between reality and performance like few others could.
It showed how effective humor could be when it felt both deeply personal and universally hilarious, tapping into celebrity gossip fascination while subverting it.
But this viral success didn't lead her down one narrow path, did it?
Not at all. From 2011 onwards, we saw Silverman embark on increasingly divergent paths, new ventures, showcasing incredible range, refusing to be pigeonholed.
Yes. After the sitcom and viral fame, she began taking more serious, dramatic acting roles.
Notably starring as Geraldine in Take This Waltz in 2011, alongside Michelle Williams and Seth Rogen.
Well, we're received at TIFF, and she got attention for a nude scene.
She did. Initially claimed she'd gained weight for the part because director Sarah Polley wanted real bodies.
But later admitted.
Later admitted it was just her characteristic, self-deprecating humor. She hadn't actually gained weight. Another example of her subverting expectations, poking fun at her own image, even in a challenging, vulnerable, dramatic role.
It really expanded her artistic range.
And while exploring dramatic roles, she simultaneously became a voice acting icon to a whole new generation.
Voicing Vanellope von Schweetz in Wreck-It Ralph and Ralph Breaks the Internet.
Yeah, 2012 and 2018. This role was a fascinating departure. Vanellope is feisty, irreverent, yet ultimately endearing.
Starts as a glitch, mirroring Silverman's own outsider persona.
Exactly. It introduced her to a whole new generation of fans, showcased a softer, more universally accessible side of her comedic talent, proving she could translate her unique energy into a family-friendly character without losing her edge.
She also delved into digital innovation, demonstrating a forward-thinking approach.
Co-created the YouTube comedy channel Jash in March 2013.
With Michael Cera, Reggie Watts, Tim and Eric. Impressive lineup.
Yeah. This move allowed them to experiment with short-form, often experimental, comedy outside the traditional studio system, embracing the digital landscape, showing her adaptability.
She continued taking more film roles, too.
Played Ruth, a no-nonsense prostitute, in Seth MacFarlane's A Million Ways to Die in the West in 2014, another distinctive character.
Her television presence continued to evolve, too, right? With the Hulu talk show.
Hosted I Love You, America with Sarah Silverman from 2017 to 2018. Unique blend of political commentary and her comedic style, but more intimate. Conversational.
Trying to bridge political divides.
Yeah, finding common ground through humor and genuine engagement with everyday Americans. Showcasing a more empathetic side while still delivering sharp social observations.
And then, during the pandemic, she launched her podcast.
The Sarah Silverman Podcast, October 2020, became an even more personal, unfiltered space. Discusses personal life, societal issues, politics, current events.
Often directly engaging with listener call-ins.
Exactly. A testament to her adaptability and desire to connect on a profoundly human level, even when discussing complex topics.
Beyond performance, her 2010 memoir, The Bedwetter, offered that deeply personal, vulnerable look into her life.
Revealing intimate childhood struggles. And that book was later adapted into an off-Broadway musical in 2022.
For which she wrote the book and lyrics herself. Earned award nominations.
It's incredible how she mines her most intimate struggles, things many would hide for humor and artistic expression, transforming vulnerability into powerful, relatable art.
Indeed. And she's certainly not slowing down. Her recent stand-up specials continue to get critical acclaim.
Someone You Love on Max in 2023 got a Golden Globe nomination, won a Writers Guild Award, shows her voice is as sharp and relevant as ever.
And looking ahead, her special Postmortem, set for May 2025 on Netflix.
Promises an even deeper dive into personal experience. Poignantly deals with grieving her parents who tragically passed away just 9 days apart in 2023.
That willingness to bring raw, current, deeply personal experiences to the stage, transforming profound loss into art. It's a powerful hallmark of her continued evolution.
It really is.
And as if that weren't enough, she just began hosting Stupid Pet Tricks on TBS in 2024.
Yeah, based on Letterman's classic segment. A wonderful full circle moment connecting back to her early Letterman appearance.
But this time she's in the host's chair, giving pet owners a chance to showcase their pet's antics.
It's a softer, more lighthearted role, showcasing her versatility even further.
This incredible breadth of work really shows how she continuously reinvents herself while staying true to that core comedic voice.
But of course, with such a bold voice comes the art of provocation. And navigating controversies has been a recurring, almost defining theme throughout her career.
That's putting it mildly. Her comedic style has consistently pushed boundaries, and sometimes those boundaries push back hard.
Remember 2001 on Conan O'Brien? She used the racial slur chink, ironically, part of a joke about avoiding jury duty.
Immediately sparked outrage. Guy Aoki of Man AA objected publicly. Led to that discussion on Politically Incorrect with Bill Maher.
Where she famously defended the joke, didn't apologize at the time. Argument was she was highlighting racism by making light of it, not endorsing it.
Years later, reflecting in the history of comedy, she said she learned her style isn't for everyone, but she genuinely didn't want to be viewed as racist. That wasn't her intent.
It highlights that incredibly complex tightrope walk of satirical comedy. Intent versus impact can diverge dramatically.
This raises that profound question about intent versus impact, especially with historically charged language.
We see a clear pattern. Her satirical approach, intended to challenge prejudice or highlight absurdity, sometimes resulted in genuine offense, leading to significant consequences.
Like the blackface sketch from the Sarah Silverman program in 2007.
Right. Her character wore blackface, said, "I look like the beautiful Queen Latifah," part of a skit about experiencing racial discrimination.
Initially part of a satirical show, but a resurfaced still from it years later without context.
Led to her being fired from an unnamed film in 2019. Illustrates the lasting repercussions, the evolving cultural sensitivities, especially when digital content gets decontextualized.
And it wasn't just race. Her religious humor also caused intense reactions.
In Jesus's Magic, 2005, she delivered that line, deadpan smile, "I'm glad the Jews killed Jesus. I'd do it again."
Clearly intended as provocative, dark humor, part of her satirical engagement with religious identity.
But its impact wasn't lighthearted for everyone. In 2019, she received death wishes from two Baptist pastors over it.
Who publicly condemned her. She, in turn, condemned their response, calling it a manipulation of what can be true.
Emphasizing how context and comedic intent can be twisted, these incidents underscore the volatile nature of controversial comedy, how differently it can be perceived.
Absolutely. The line between satire and offense isn't just subjective, it's constantly shifting, especially as public discourse evolves.
And beyond comedic controversies, Silverman has also been a very vocal, active figure in political discourse, taking strong, unapologetic stances.
Often putting her right in the midst of public debate. Her political statements and activism are a significant part of her public persona now.
Indeed. Most recently, during the deeply sensitive Israel-Gaza war in 2023.
She shared an Instagram post supporting Israel's restriction of food, water, electricity to Gaza. Sparked significant criticism, outrage.
Viewed by many as advocating collective punishment. She later took it down, claiming she hadn't read it in full before sharing.
This emotionally charged situation led to further political action from her. She announced her departure from the Democratic Socialists of America, the DSA.
Despite having been a proud lifetime member, she cited their response to the initial Hamas attacks, which she felt didn't adequately condemn Hamas, and a perceived lack of support for Israel as her reasons.
A powerful illustration of her willingness to take a public stand on divisive issues, even facing backlash from former allies or changing her own affiliations.
Her activism extends elsewhere too, like her 2012 PSA criticizing new voter ID laws.
Funded by the Jewish Council for Education and Research, argued they created unnecessary obstacles, particularly for groups finding it hard to get specific IDs.
Implying they were designed to suppress votes from minority or low-income communities. The PSA itself was controversial, too.
Especially its suggestion that laws were so restrictive they could prevent even some non-citizen immigrants from voting illegally. Some saw that as endorsing illegal voting.
Right. She's also been a consistently vocal advocate for cannabis reform.
Openly opposing racial bias, unfair arrests for possession, highlighting disproportionate effects on communities of color.
Supports social justice programs for nonviolent offenders impacted by drug laws. She even invested in Lowell Herb Company, a company aiming to end cannabis prohibition.
Uses her personal experiences, like discussing her cannabis use on Conan, not just for comedy, but to normalize and advocate for change.
Her engagement in presidential elections has also been public, sometimes dramatic. Campaigned vigorously for Bernie Sanders in 2016 and 2020.
Embodied his populist appeal with her bluntness. But in 2016, after the nomination,
She famously spoke for Hillary Clinton at the DNC, amid boos from some Bernie or Bust supporters.
She turned and declared, "To the Bernie or Bust people, you're being ridiculous."
Demonstrated her pragmatic approach, prioritizing party unity, even if it alienated some initial supporters. Showed she'd speak uncomfortable truths to her own side.
It's clear she's not afraid to use her platform for causes she believes in, even facing backlash or changing her stance publicly.
This adaptability, even if controversial, is a constant thread. Her activism includes international efforts, too.
Like signing that one campaign open letter in 2015, urging focus on women's issues and development funding.
Underscoring her commitment to global causes. And more recently, that unexpected turn, becoming a prominent plaintiff in a copyright lawsuit in 2023.
Suing OpenAI and Meta platforms?
Alleging their AI models, ChatGPT and Llama, were trained on her books without permission or compensation, obtained through illegal means like pirated datasets.
That lawsuit is incredibly significant. Highlights her engagement with cutting-edge issues, IP, AI.
Places her among artists directly challenging the emerging AI training data paradigm. It's not just her books. It's a battle that could redefine creator compensation in the digital age.
Establishing precedents for ownership, fair use, when AI consumes copyrighted material.
Raises fundamental questions about authorship, compensation, the future of creative industries facing advancing AI. Shows Silverman again at the forefront of a crucial debate.
And beyond the controversies, the activism, there's the woman herself. She's been remarkably open about personal life struggles.
Revealing a depth and vulnerability that often underpins her most potent humor.
She's been incredibly candid about her lifelong battle with clinical depression.
A struggle which at one point led to a Xanax addiction. She openly credits Zoloft with helping her maintain emotional health, saying it changed her life.
That level of honesty about mental health from a public figure is invaluable. Helps destigmatize these issues.
Absolutely. She also famously struggled with bedwetting from childhood into her teens, a deeply personal, often embarrassing experience.
Even admitted to a recent instance in a 2007 interview, extraordinary willingness to share uncomfortable details.
And this struggle, as we mentioned, formed the basis of her autobiography, The Bedwetter, and the musical adaptation, transforming personal pain into universal art.
With truly fascinating ears, the sheer vulnerability she shows in sharing these personal aspects, mental health, childhood issues, evolving views on traditional life paths.
It profoundly informs her comedy, makes her characters feel incredibly real, layered, even in fictionalized settings.
Another severe health scare was in July 2016, epiglottitis.
Spent a terrifying week in the ICU at Cedars-Sinai, a serious, potentially life-threatening condition. She later shared she felt lucky to be alive.
An experience that certainly provides profound perspective on life. Mortality must color her outlook.
Inevitably. More recently, 2022 revealed on her podcast she has misophonia, a condition where certain sounds trigger strong responses. Noticed it as a teenager.
Understanding these personal battles helps us grasp the raw, often uncomfortable honesty in her work.
Her views on relationships and family life are as unconventional and candid as her comedy.
Famously stated, she wouldn't marry until same-sex couples could legally do so. Powerful stance, resonated with many.
Highlighted her commitment to social justice. But after same-sex marriage was legalized, she tweeted in 2014, "I will never get married."
Adding, "Why would I want the governed involved in my love life? Ew, it's barbaric."
Reflects a broader philosophy valuing individual autonomy over societal conventions, perfectly in line with her independent spirit.
And her views on having children are equally transparent, provocative.
Explicitly stated she doesn't want biological children. Cited two key reasons.
Firstly, the millions of kids that have no parents, suggesting adoption or fostering.
Secondly, her desire to avoid passing on her own clinical depression. Incredibly honest, personal consideration.
In 2017, added she prioritized her artistic career, the touring lifestyle, over motherhood's demands.
These choices, shared openly, challenge traditional expectations for women, foster conversation about different paths to fulfillment.
Throughout her career, her personal relationships have often intertwined, sometimes dramatically, with her public persona and comedy.
Briefly dated comedians Kevin Brennan, Dave Attell, most prominent relationship, Jimmy Kimmel, 2002-2009.
Their on-again, off-again dynamic was often referenced, mined for humor in her comedy, like the St. Christopher Medal joke.
Implying guilt or irony in their interfaith relationship. Later, publicly acknowledged her relationship with actor Michael Sheen, 2014-2018.
Noting they consciously uncoupled over Christmas in 2018. Very modern, gentle way to describe the split.
More recently, since 2020, dating Rory Albanese, former Daily Show runner.
Her family life also plays an important, visible role. Her sister Laura famously played her sister on the Sarah Silverman program.
Blurring the lines between actual relationship and fictionalized one, adding meta commentary, and her older sister Susan is a reform rabbi in Jerusalem.
Fascinating contrast to Sarah's own agnostic, culturally Jewish identity.
This diverse family tapestry undoubtedly provides rich material, deep support, varying perspectives for her work, a vibrant personal ecosystem.
As for where she lives, previously West Hollywood.
Now maintains residences in both Los Feliz, California, and the East Village, Manhattan, maintaining ties to both coasts that shaped her career.
So what stands out to you about Sarah Silverman's truly unparalleled journey? Is it her relentless pursuit of humor facing constant controversy, her unwavering willingness to share deepest vulnerabilities, her continuously evolving activism?
It's hard to pick just one thing, isn't it?
We've seen her transform from a young comedian with an awful first set into an accomplished actress commanding Disney films, an Emmy-winning writer, an activist unafraid to take a stand.
She consistently blends sharp, often uncomfortable, satire with surprising raw vulnerability, makes her one of the most compelling and, yeah, challenging voices of our time.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, Silverman's career asks us to consider the evolving role of comedy itself, right? In confronting uncomfortable truths.
And how an artist can continuously reinvent themselves, shocking jokes to dramatic roles to personal podcasting, while staying true to a fiercely individual voice.
Her path exemplifies the tension and triumph of being radically honest in the public eye.
Even when that honesty sparks outrage or demands personal sacrifice, her willingness to share her flaws, changing perspectives, very real grief suggests that maybe true authenticity in comedy isn't just about making people laugh.
But about making them think.
Yeah.
And sometimes making them squirm.
All while openly navigating her own complex humanity, her journey challenges us to reflect on our own comfort zones, the power of an unfiltered voice.
And the enduring impact of an artist who refuses to fit neatly into any box in an increasingly curated world.